It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I am Tony Vernetti from Feds, Federal Employee Defense Services. And I believe this is our first show in the new year. So happy 2014, everyone. And since this is the start of a new year, it is fitting that we're going to start the year off here at Fed Talk with a look back at 2013 and what it meant for federal and local law enforcement in terms of officer safety and fatalities in the line of duty. Specifically, we'll be discussing the year-end report that's compiled by the good folks over at the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund about officer fatalities in 2013. So let me introduce our guests. Since it's a report compiled by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, we, of course, are pleased to have our good friend Craig Floyd in studio with me. Craig is the chairman and CEO of the Memorial Fund. Craig, good morning. Good to see you. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be back, Tony.
And our other guest today is John Adler, the president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, or FLEOA. And if you are a Fed Talk regular, you know that John is a frequent contributor and a guest for us at Fed Talk, and certainly someone we like to bring on whenever we are discussing law enforcement-related issues. And I believe John is one of three active law enforcement officers who is on the Memorial Board, Memorial Fund's board. So, John, we appreciate you calling in today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony, and Happy New Year to both you and my good friend, Craig.
Just a reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. So today we're going to discuss the year-end report compiled by the Memorial Fund about officer fatalities in 2013. But before we do that, Craig, I always like for you to introduce the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund to our listeners and tell us a little bit about where it's located and how it got started.
Thank you, Tony. We started our organization in 1984. I was actually working for a congressman at the time. I had the privilege of serving 10 years as the legislative assistant to Congressman Mario Biaggi. He was a New York City police officer before he came to Congress. He served for 23 years, the most decorated cop in New York City history, when he retired in 1965, wounded 10 times in the line of duty. So he had a great appreciation for the service and the sacrifices made by our law enforcement professionals. He knew that the nation, generally speaking, had not fully appreciated that service and sacrifice, and he initiated legislation to build the first ever National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. And in 84, we started down that path, and in 1991, we dedicated the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. It's now proudly sitting in Judiciary Square, the 400 block of E Street, Northwest Washington, just a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol and just off the National Mall. And on the walls of that memorial are the names of 19,981 federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial officers who've made the ultimate sacrifice across this nation of ours. That was 91. Fast forward to 1998, we engaged in a long-term strategic planning study for our organization. What did we want to do for the next 10 to 30 years? And we decided one of those initiatives had to be building a National Law Enforcement Museum so that the complete story of law enforcement service and sacrifice could finally be told. And that museum is underway. We hope to open it in 2016, and it will sit right across the street from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. And our final mission, if you will, is to promote law enforcement safety. And we do that by sharing information about how law enforcement professionals are killed in the line of duty. And that's one of the reasons we issue an end-of-year fatality report each year. And that's one of the things we'll be talking about here today.
And John, as the president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, just tell us a little bit about your association and how you work with Craig and the Memorial Fund throughout the year.
Well, we are a nonpartisan professional association representing federal law enforcement officers from 65 different federal agencies. We have approximately 26,000 members. We are proud to serve as the voice of federal law enforcement on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C., as well as provide numerous charity type of functions among our many chapters across the country. One of the things in my role as president of FLEO, or one of the privileges I have, is serving with Craig Floyd on the executive board of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial. FLEO is an active partner with the memorial. We are committed to the National Museum campaign to get the first National Law Enforcement Museum erected, as well as maintain our sacred wall. And I will say this, Tony, as part of your introduction for Craig Floyd, I have to say that in addition to someone who is sort of the CEO of the entity that accumulates statistics, we see him as he's our chief guardian who protects and preserves our sacred memorial wall. And that is the most important thing to us, for that's where the names are inscribed forever of our fallen heroes. So I'd sort of like to acknowledge and recognize Craig for that, as well as the important statistical data that we're going to discuss today.
Well, certainly, we all echo that. And I should mention that, you know, entry to the memorial is free. You know, anybody can go over there and take a look at it, and should take a look at it. So, Craig, let's talk about the statistics, the year-end data. How long has the Memorial Fund been tracking and keeping the statistics? And generally, what is it used for?
You know, the history of our research effort really dates back to 1988. At that time, we were trying to determine whether or not to put the names of fallen officers on our national memorial that we were designing at that time. And the initial thought was, you know, could we do a memorial without the names? And then we looked down the street and we saw the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and how that had really struck a chord with this nation of ours. And of course, the main feature of that memorial are the names inscribed on that black granite wall that you see down there near the Lincoln Memorial. And we said, my goodness, we have to put the names of the fallen officers on our memorial to really make it a heartfelt tribute to those men and women. And so then the challenge was, okay, how do we find out who those officers were that died in the line of duty? We're not the Department of Defense. We didn't track law enforcement fatalities in a federal clearinghouse somewhere. We did have the FBI's statistics and names and fatality figures dating back to about 1961. And so at one point we said, well, maybe we should start with that year and move forward and then just keep track of it as we go. And then, of course, the obvious thought was, well, what about the officers who died before 1961? How can we ignore them? So we engaged on a nationwide research effort, never been done before. And we asked every law enforcement agency in this country, there's more than 18,000 of them, did you have a line of duty death, and could you send us the names of those officers that died in the line of duty in your department's history? We engaged the Attorney General of the United States at the time, asked him to sign a letter for us to those agencies. He did that. We still didn't get a complete record and response from those agencies. So then we hired a telemarketing firm, if you will. Those are usually the people that call you up and ask you for money. In our case, they were calling the agencies around this country to see if they had any law enforcement fatalities. Those agencies began sending us that information in greater numbers. And when we first dedicated the memorial, there were 12,561 names inscribed on those marble walls. And we thought we'd done a pretty good job of finding the older deaths. But since then, I dare say we probably added thousands and thousands of officers who died in yesteryear, earlier in our history, who had been totally forgotten about. And only thanks to our researchers in our office, plus volunteers around the country, were we able to find these older deaths. And today, as I said earlier, we have 19,981 names on that memorial. And we still have many others, I'm afraid, that still are unaccounted for, so, and we're going to find them.
So you're really adding, you know, each year, people even just further back than the immediate preceding year. You know, I know this year you added somebody as far back as 1814, Mr. Stout.
It's amazing. You're right. John Stout was a customs agent, and he had actually died trying to make the arrest of the famous pirate John Lafitte. And he was killed in the line of duty doing so. And his name had been forgotten about, slipped through the cracks of history. This past May, we made sure that he was forgotten no more. And this year's the same thing. We found some officers who died in the early 1800s. Once again, their names will go on this May 13th at our candlelight vigil at the memorial where we always dedicate the new names. So I think that's an unending task. I doubt if we'll ever in our lifetime say that we've found every officer who's ever died in the line of duty, but we're going to do our best to make sure it happens.
Great. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm here at Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund and John Adler from FLIOA. We'll continue our discussion after this, our first break, and a word from our sponsor.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is, GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am Tony Vernetti, and I'm talking with Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund and John Adler from the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. And we're talking about the year-end law enforcement officer fatality report that is compiled by the Memorial Fund. So, Craig, let's jump into what the preliminary data shows for 2013. And, you know, we're fortunate to see that it's continuing with a bit of a trend and a decrease for officer fatality.
Yes, for the second year in a row, we saw a fairly significant decline in law enforcement fatalities across this country. We, based on preliminary data that we've received, are reporting that 111 federal, state, local, territorial, and tribal officers across this country died in the line of duty in 2013. That's the bad news. 111 brave men and women who've died, making it safer for the citizens that they serve. And we will always honor and remember them and their families during this very difficult time. However, there is some good news in that story. 111 fatalities is the lowest figure since 1959. So it's been more than 50 years since we found a year that was any safer when it came to fatalities for law enforcement officers. And that's the second year in a row that we've seen those record low levels. Very significantly, the number of officers killed by firearms, 33 this past year. That was the lowest number since 1887. Dating back to the Wild West days. It's pretty incredible to think that since 1887, we've never seen a year where there were fewer officers killed by firearms. And that's a trend that's been continuing since those numbers peaked in 2011 when 71 officers were actually shot and killed. So that's a very significant decline over a two-year period. And I want to give a lot of credit for that decline to the U.S. Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, and his Department of Justice. He has made, since those numbers were so alarming just a couple years ago, made law enforcement safety one of his top priorities as Attorney General. And that has made a difference. Everywhere he goes, he speaks about the need to make it safer for our officers. He created a program called Valor, which trains officers to deal with violent confrontations with criminals. How do you survive those confrontations? How can you prevent them? And he's done something else. He created a national officer safety and wellness group, which I'm proud to be a member of. We talk about safety and wellness issues all the time, and we're sharing information with departments around this country that are going to make it safer for our officers. So 33 officers shot and killed, the lowest since 1887. We still have a long way to go, a lot of work left to do, but we're certainly moving in the right direction. The other area that we saw some good news in, although not quite as good as the firearms-related category, traffic-related fatalities totaled 46 last year. That was the lowest number since 1991. But I would also point out that for the 13th year out of the last 15, traffic-related incidents have been the number one cause of death for officers in this country.
And I want to come back to the traffic related deaths in a little bit. But, John, I'd like for you to comment on the statistics. And specifically, you know, when we talk about that, we see a trend, it going down. It's the lowest in six decades. And as Craig pointed out, it even included as far back as Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral out there in Tucson. But it doesn't mean, from your perspective, it doesn't mean that the job of a law enforcement officer is getting any easier. When we look at the one of the leading causes of firearm fatalities is still, you know, being ambushed. I was wondering if you can comment on that from a from the federal law enforcement officer's perspective.
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point, Tony, which is, and it's on the cover page of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Research Bulletin, which I encourage all listeners to review and read. It's an incredible report. Ambush attacks were the leading circumstance of fatal shootings in 2013 yet again. And that's a big concern for us folks out in the field, and we're working very hard to get that number down. My concern, both as an active law enforcement officer as well as a representative of those out in the field, is that our elected officials not draw a wrong conclusion based on these statistics and the positive point of this being a very low year for us. As Craig often says, if we lose one officer, that's unacceptable, and it's terrible, and it's tragic. So my concern is that we need to pay closer attention to some of the reality behind, or perhaps even partially hidden beneath or behind the statistics. For instance, looking at data regarding the proliferation of violent gangs, looking at data regarding the proliferation of international trafficking organizations, gun traffickers, drug traffickers, human traffickers, as well as, of course, terrorist factions that are increasing. And my point is that we don't want members of Congress to draw the conclusion that criminals are now less dangerous, when in fact we just got better that particular year, and perhaps for the grace of God and also from great messaging from organizations like Craig's, really emphasizing the need to wear your vest, to wear your seatbelt. These things, education contributes to the reduction of fatalities, but we still want our elected officials to properly fund all law enforcement components and not take this for granted. Do not belittle the reality of what we're facing out there in the streets, which is a very formidable group of violent criminals, and we need to maintain our resources to effectively combat them while keeping down as best we can our fatalities.
You know, I've done this show, you know, a few years with you, Craig, and, you know, obviously, John, we've been on a bunch together. And, you know, I'm always amazed when I hear the statistic that the traffic-related incidents are the, you know, the number one reason for officer fatalities. And, I've often wondered, is that just, you know, Tony, me being naive in this? And I would ask friends, you know, when I'm out and about, you know, just sort of, hey, what do you think is the, you know, and not a lot of people, you know, point to or would suggest traffic-related incidents or deaths because it's not what they see on TV, you know, or it's not, you know, what's being put in the news and things like that. Craig, I wonder if you can, you know, comment on I don't know, the reason or, you know, what's really behind sort of that trend And, you know, what do you see law enforcement agencies doing to combat that?
Well, there's a number of factors at work here, and I will point to Canada as a good example of how to do it right. They have a program in the academy and then in service training they provide that impresses upon their officers a policy called guaranteed arrival. That means your first and foremost concern as an officer when you get that call for help, whether it be from another officer, an innocent citizen in need, whatever, get to that call safely, all right? You don't have to drive at high rates of speed that are unsafe to ensure that an emergency is properly tended to. 42% of the officers killed in auto crashes last year died in single car crashes. All right. That means in most cases they were responding to an emergency at faster speeds than are probably safe for the conditions they were dealing with. They lost control of the vehicle and they ended up dying in trying to get to help someone else. They never made it to the call. So guaranteed arrival is a very important philosophy that more and more departments are emphasizing. Many departments have, in fact, imposed serious restrictions on their officers in terms of when they engage in high-speed pursuits. Only when they think that that fleeing suspect is going to pose a threat to human life, either theirs or someone else, will they chase that fleeing felon, because they realize that that poses such a great risk to the officer and to so many innocent citizens. Something else we need to do a better job of, and that is getting every officer to wear their seatbelt. All right. 42% of the officers killed in auto crashes are not wearing their seatbelts. Now, is that because they're lazy or they're irresponsible? No. They are very concerned that their gun belt oftentimes gets tangled up in their seatbelt. They're responding to a situation that may involve gunfire, that may involve getting in and out of their vehicle very quickly for their own safety or for the safety of some innocent citizen in need. So a lot of times they don't buckle their seatbelt as they arrive on a crime scene. And sometimes getting to that scene, they end up getting injured or killed in an auto crash. Another concern I have is that so many of the agencies provide twice as much firearms-related training for their officers as they do driver training. We need to do better with driver training. More officers need to get better trained behind the wheels of their car. Most officers in their career will be involved in a high-speed emergency response or chase, and only about 10% will ever fire their weapon in the line of duty.
You know, it's interesting. I want to have John comment on one of the things you mentioned, because when you gave the example for Canada, you know, really what you're talking about is starting to shift and change the culture, you know, of you know, what affects federal law enforcement officers. And I'd be interested, you know, to get John's comment as an active law enforcement officer on how that's, you know, working throughout the law enforcement community, because it's in their DNA to react. They run into, you know, they run in when people are running out, right? They don't think, they instinctively act. So John, you know, I wonder, you know, what's happening out there to sort of change the culture, have law enforcement officers maybe think of me safety first, and that allows me to do my job better.
Yeah, I know. We have competing voices in our head sometimes. And, you know, sometimes in spite of all the great work that Craig and Memorial have done with the messaging and FLEO and other organizations, when something happens, when something erupts unexpectedly, you know, perhaps sometimes the educational voice gets put down by the desire to run in and rescue, you know, and save lives, which, of course, then sort of shifts the risk, you know, against us. But you know what? We all accept that. You know, we do. We know going in that there's no guarantee we're going to make it to our mortal finish line of you know, retirement. We know that and we accept it. But I just want to hit on one thing quickly with the vehicle side as well, that the only other thing I ask for, and which contributes to these vehicle fatalities sometimes, is improper vehicle maintenance. And again, it relies on funding so that police departments, federal agencies, state departments, county and tribal have the funding to maintain their vehicles to ensure they're operating correctly so as to minimize the risk of losing control and going off the side of the road while moving at higher speeds. But yeah, Tony, that's one of those things we're always struggling with, which is our instinct and, as you said, our DNA. You know, we sort of set ourselves aside and we focus almost exclusively on the task at hand, which is either, you know, rescuing or combating a violent crime that's being committed in our presence or we're heading to. And you know what? That part we're not going to change. You can't change our DNA, but it's what Craig was emphasizing, which is something as simple as wearing your vest, in theory. Something as such as simple as putting on your seatbelt. And I feel that pain, too. I get a sort of claustrophobic response to wearing it, but then I sort of have that little, you know, split personality conversation with myself and say, hey, knucklehead, you're accountable to your family, too, as well as control of your vehicle, and put on the seatbelt, because if you get hit while in the vehicle by another one, it'll help to maintain your control and minimize the possibility of you hurting someone. So you sort of have these little conversations with yourself, but ultimately, with all of that reinforcement, with the data being put out, it does ultimately resonate and sometimes get through our, what you might call, occasionally thick skull. Well intended, but thick.
I think it's something that, you know, really needs to come from the top down, you know, and both on a macro and micro level, whether it's the head of the agency, you know, establishing a policy or you know, repeating, you know, to its managers that this is an important part of your job, in my perspective, or whether it's the SAC, you know, ASAC group supervisor, a particular group, communicating to their agents, you know, their law enforcement officers about the importance of safety. You know, that's the way you create the culture. You let them know that that's important to you, that that's okay to take care of yourself first. We have to stop here for our second break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the 2013 year-end officer fatality data that is compiled by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Tony Vernetti, and we're talking with Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund and John Nadler from the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. And we're discussing the 2013 year-end officer fatality data that is compiled by the Memorial Fund. Before the break, in the first half of the show, we've been talking about the kind of law enforcement officer deaths that you think about, you know, the in the line of duty, you know, exchanging gunfire, you know, engaging with the bad guy, or the vehicle related deaths, the traffic related deaths. But we have officers, unfortunately, who die for other reasons. I know there's 32 officers that died due to other causes, and a significant number of those were due to heart attacks. And you know, Craig, I'd like for you to first start to comment on that. When I see that statistic, you know, the immediate thing, you know, that jumps out to me is what people forget is stress. You know, there's stress, you know, that goes along, you know, with being a federal, you know, law enforcement officer. You know, the stress, you know, that goes along before you, you know, you put your belt on, before you, you know, before you grab your badge and gun and go to work. And You know, and there's a lot of, you know, medical ramifications from that, you know, that I think the general public really doesn't appreciate.
Well, John, as a working cop, can certainly comment more about the stress of the job, but I will tell you that the numbers this past year were rather startling. 14 officers died of heart attacks in 2013 while conducting their duties, and that's not just officers sitting at their desk. We don't really those officers who may not be involved in a particularly stressful incident would not qualify for inclusion on the National Memorial. However, if an officer is chasing a fleeing felon on foot, engaging in a hand-to-hand struggle with a resisting a felon, if an officer is responding at a high rate of speed to an emergency call that involves serious injury or death, as is often the case, that officer would be included on the memorial if, in fact, that stressful incident causes a heart attack within 24 hours of that incident. That's what our criteria says. So when you look at 14 who met that criteria seemingly this past year, that's a big jump from the prior year when we saw 8 officers who died of heart attacks in the line of duty. So obviously that got our attention. That got a lot of people's attention. What can we do to deal with this stress of the job, the heart attacks and strokes that may result from it? Obviously, physical fitness is a part of that. A lot of agencies today are allowing officers to work out during working hours. They're putting gyms within the station houses and the headquarters. That's all helpful. But the fact of the matter is that sudden stress kills. We've seen studies where in earthquake situations, for example, in California, there was a much higher incidence of heart attack deaths among the citizenry in those those earthquake situations than is normally the case. That's just one example. So you would obviously agree that it's more likely that an officer who has to deal with sudden stress as part of the normal routine of the job, that's going to occasionally kill and cause serious injury and even heart disease over a long period of time for those officers. So that's a troubling aspect of the job. A lot of PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder that you hear for the military, soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq, the same thing happens with officers. You're dealing with trauma. You have to live with that. That's great stress on the body. And now you're asked to then go home to your family and be a normal human being. It's not that easy, and stress sometimes can kill.
Yeah, I know PTSD is a huge thing, I know, you know, in law enforcement. And John, I know that's a topic that's near and dear, you know, to you, for the federal folks, in getting proper recognition through OWCP and Department of Labor. But I wonder if you can just comment on stress in general in the law enforcement position.
Yeah, it reminds me of dealing with members of Congress. It's sort of it's a hidden stress that's sometimes not readily apparent, but then when you go home and you're sort of unconsciously pulling your hair out and you know, doing things like biting your fingernails as an adult, and you realize that it's not the threat in front of you. Sometimes it's a threat within. I think in addition to the obvious risks we face, you know, the possibility of bodily injury and things we witness, you know, it's also just it's very difficult. You have rotating schedules. You're working, you know, after hours. The job can move at a very fast pace. Our eating habits are constantly interrupted. You know, we have a saying, much like the military, you eat when you can and as well as use the facilities, because you just never know when it's going to get interrupted. And the other factor which really hurts us is sleep. You know, myself included, we're not good sleepers in terms of we take our work home. And, you know, as much as we try and leave it behind, it's in our mind, it's in our veins. And when your heart's still racing, you know, at a pace of 160 beats per minute, it's very difficult to put your head down on a pillow and go to sleep. And that certainly impacts your health as well. But, yes, stress is definitely a silent killer for us. And I think the more we're aware of it, the more we think about it, the more we have the opportunity to take active steps to minimize it. You know, we're not going to eliminate stress, much like we're not going to eliminate risk. But, again, awareness is one of the best things that can come our way to help reduce it. And, you know, that's one of the great things the Memorial does by way of its research and its reports that it publishes.
John, do you see the various law enforcement organizations that you deal with acknowledging that, being aware of it? You know, so many people sometimes turn a blind eye to it and say, look, life's stressful, you know, deal with it. You know, why is your job any different, you know, than anybody else's? You know, everyone's perception is their own reality. But what do you see within the organizations as far as, you know, increasing awareness to the situation involving stress or PTSD? And are they doing anything about it?
I think that there's been improvement in the messaging. I think there's been an increase in agencies and departments accepting the benefits and value of wellness programs as opposed to mandatory fitness standards, which are just ridiculous to codify or validate. Wellness programs are important. They're voluntary. You know, you don't have the pressure. You're not competing for a score. It's really all about the individual and sort of recognizing what are those precursors for heart disease, you know, for a stroke, whether it's obesity, whether it's hypertension, high blood pressure, even just you know, the good old heredity factor as well. And the more we're aware of it, you know, the better we are armed. It's not just carrying a weapon in the holster, it's carrying knowledge in our holster as well. I think the agencies have gotten better, but, you know, Tony, like everything else, when the money isn't there, what gets cut first? Training. And wellness programs and fitness falls under training, and it gets overlooked. And the other issue is that because of the hiring freezes and the high rate of attrition, there are less of us. So there are less of us trying to do more. And that also is a tremendous factor into the stress level. And it doesn't provide time to simply go, you know, get a manicure and a workout. That just ain't the lifestyle opportunity for us.
I want to take a step back a little bit because Craig, during the break, mentioned a statistic to me involving traffic-related deaths that I thought was staggering, that, you know, I think our listeners should want to hear about how many officers were killed in the line of duty by drivers who were impaired.
Drunk driving has taken the lives of hundreds of law enforcement officers across this country. And what we've found, Tony, is that if you look back to the 1970s and then look at each decade following it, now the 70s, I would argue, would probably be a time when we were starting to really crack down on drunk driving, changing the culture of driving drunk on the roadway. And law enforcement obviously is at the center of that. A lot of officers out there looking for drunk drivers. Unfortunately, too many of those drunk drivers have found those officers in very dangerous situations. We've seen more than a 40% increase since the 70s of officers killed by drunk drivers. And that's at a time when drunk driving deaths overall have gone down in this country. So obviously, we still have a lot of work to do in keeping drunk drivers off the roadways. And if we were better successful at that, there'd be a lot fewer deaths among law enforcement officers.
Craig, do you see any overall, you know, with the statistics as far as fatalities, do you see any trends as far as state by state? State by state is one state, you know, traditionally has higher fatalities than another state. I know this past year, Texas had the most with 13, you know, California the most with 10. You know, conventional wisdom would say they're large states. You know, they got more people, you know, so that's just the rule of large numbers working. But do you see any trend there one way or the other throughout the years?
Well, typically, Texas and California do seem to vie for that unwanted distinction of being the state with the most law enforcement fatalities year after year. Historically, Texas leads the nation with more than 1,600 officers killed in the line of duty in their state. California is second with more than 1,500 fatalities. But interestingly, you look at the states with the most deaths in this past year, Texas number one with 13, followed by California with 10. But then in the number three position, New York, as you might expect, another large populous state with a lot of law enforcement officers serving. But Mississippi also tied with New York for the third most deaths, seven in their state. And Mississippi has had about 200 fatalities historically. And you wonder, how in the world could Mississippi have seven deaths in one year? And you see that year after year, seemingly. There's a state that just jumps out of the crowd. You wouldn't expect Mississippi to have that number. But unfortunately, when you're a law enforcement professional, sometimes those odds simply catch up
and
with you.
You have Arkansas right behind them with six.
And you wouldn't
think that as well.
No. And interestingly, studies have shown that if you work in rural areas, sometimes the odds of being killed in the line of duty as an officer are greater than those who work in urban areas.
Interesting. We're going to stop here and hear a word from our sponsor. When we return, we'll wrap up today's discussion with Craig and John. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We are entering our last segment of the show, and we've been, for a large part of the show, we've been discussing the 2013 year-end data that's compiled by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund about officer fatalities. So for our last segment, you know, I'd like to, you know, we often compile, you know, these reports, statistics, get data. You know, what does it mean? We see a trend going down. This is the lowest in six, you know, decades. But as, you know, as John says, as you say, if we have one officer killed in a line of duty, that's too much. You know, what can we, you know, what can agencies do with the data in order to, you know, we talked about earlier, promote this culture of safety? You know, what can agencies do differently, you know, to help law enforcement officers be more safe? Obviously, you can't control, you know, the bad guy that's out there and it's doing X, Y, and Z. And, you know, unfortunately, things like that are going to happen, you know, but what can we do on the other side of it? What have you seen?
Well, one of the especially favorable trends, I think, is the number of agencies that are now requiring their officers to wear body armor. All right. Body armor, soft body armor anyway, the bullet resistant vests that we typically associate with law enforcement officers on patrol really began to be used back in the mid 70s. But it's only been in recent years that we've seen significantly high numbers of officers wearing them on a routine basis. 4 years ago, about 60% of the agencies in this country were making it mandatory that their officers wear body armor. A study by the Police Executive Research Forum, one of our board organizations, found over the last year that now that number is more than 90% of the agencies in this country require their officers to wear body armor. Body armor has been credited with saving the lives, and this is documented, saving the lives of more than 3,100 officers over about the last 30 years. So wearing your vest saves lives. Unfortunately, more than 30% of the officers who died in the line of duty the last couple of years were not wearing body armor. So that's one important area. Similarly, seatbelts are now being required. It's mandatory to wear your seatbelts in a growing number of agencies around this country. And if you're not wearing your seatbelt, you could be subject to disciplinary action. So that is also something that is going to save lives. I mentioned earlier, 42% of the officers killed in auto crashes not wearing their seatbelts. Simple philosophies that are being impressed upon officers: drive slower. We talked about the guaranteed arrival philosophy. Get to that call safely. You know, officers have this tendency, as John said, to want to get there as quickly as they can because they know somebody needs their help. But first and foremost, get there safely. More agencies providing officers with taser, stun guns, and less lethal weaponry. Very important. I was riding in Minnesota, Minneapolis area with a deputy sheriff, and I noticed he was wearing a taser stun gun, and I'm a big advocate of tasers. And I asked him what he thought about it, and he said, let me tell you this, Craig. He says, other than my lethal weapon I have on my other side, this is the most important piece of weaponry I have, most important piece of equipment. He said, in the year before I got this taser, I was engaging in hand-to-hand combat with resisting suspects once a week at least. He said, since I started wearing this taser a year ago, I have not had one instance of hand-to-hand combat. So that's making a difference. I think, too, we're seeing innovation and progressive tendencies. I know the chief in Boca Raton, Florida, came up and spoke to our National Officer and Safety Group. He said one of the things they do is reward safe behavior. If an officer hasn't been in an at-fault crash during the prior year, they get a $1,200 bonus, a reward for conducting themselves in a very safe fashion. So I think it's important that we do more to reward safe behavior and maybe less emphasis on disciplining and punishing officers that might engage in bad or unsafe behavior. And finally, I would point to this. Very important that you get management working with the unions to establish good policies when it comes to safety. Not enough for management to simply impose upon their officers this mandatory vest wear, mandatory seatbelt wear policy. You know, have the unions join them. Get the data to support the rationale behind those policies. There's a great message, slogan that we use. If it matters, measure it. All right. Get some good statistical data like we provide from the Memorial Fund. Give that to the unions, to the management folks, and get them to establish policies based on that data.
John, I wonder if you can comment from the perspective of the federal law enforcement community. We often say, you know, the federal government should be the model employer to the rest of the country. You know, the same is true for the federal law enforcement agencies. You know, what do you see as far as agencies taking the lead on this kind of safety first concept?
I think, you know, Tony, it's easy to take the lead or embrace a concept. It's more difficult to do anything meaningful with it. And I think it's more, I mean, I'm not going to come out and just attack the agencies because I realize they're under tremendous financial constraints. I think it's really a cooperative effort. I mean, one thing the agencies can do in a proactive sense is engage corporate partners like DuPont, for instance, to come up with, solve problems, come up with vests that agents, officers would be more inclined to wear, which would provide them the protection, but also the maneuverability and comfort that they would might be perhaps more more apt to wear them in the field.
Let me ask you right there, so, John, because most people, yeah. Like you would say, well, why the heck wouldn't an officer wear a vest? Isn't it just as easy, you know, to put on a seatbelt? You know, our listeners from the law enforcement perspective, tell us, you know, why a law enforcement wouldn't put on a vest.
Yeah, nothing I'm about to say will justify it or appear rational, but right. I will just seize upon another one of my irrational moments. We do it because we're human beings. And one thing is, there is a restriction sometimes in the vest. They don't always fit properly. You know, we grow. You know, folks like me tend to put on a few comfort pounds. And it can limit your movement. It's uncomfortable. It's distracting. And all of these things are unacceptable, you know, whiny excuses, but it's reality. And the thing is that, you know, anything that impacts our focus, our maneuverability, you know, our sense and freedom of movement, we shun. And then, you know, then there's always also the stigma, oh, like, why are you wearing your vest? Well, it's a little thing called life and mortality that motivates me, and I have a family, and it's important that, you know, we make it home safely. But I think, Tony, again, it's some of it psychological. Some of it is also that departments, agencies could be issuing vests that don't fit properly. If they don't fit, you don't want to wear them. You could be sitting in a vehicle on a surveillance for a very long period of time where you're sitting with a vest that's digging into you. And you could say, well, if you weigh the discomfort versus the unfortunate outcome of death, you know, which would you prefer? But the answer is that this does factor into sort of bad decisions not to wear the vest.
And you were commenting on you know, agencies, you know, how they can interact and work with, you know, corporate America. You know, what have you seen, you know, on that front?
Well, I've seen better work with organizations like Craig's, unfortunately, than the agencies themselves. But I think the agencies need to be a little bit more proactive. But one thing I will say, again, in defense of the agencies is they can engage all the third-party corporations they want, but if the funding isn't there, they can't do anything with it, which falls back with all my good friends in Congress, which is recognizing the critical need to sustain the proper level of funding for all law enforcement components, local, state, and federal. When you cut into the funding, you cut into the ability to enact and implement all these important programs that would otherwise reduce risk, you know, improve wellness, and drop the numbers of law enforcement fatalities. I mean, there are other things. I'm personally concerned about the consistent high level of ambush attacks. I wish all the agencies, the fugitive task forces, all had the heat imaging technology to minimize their being ambushed when they go into a resident or any structure for any violent criminal, psychotic nutter hiding in a closet or somewhere. You know, I just have too many bad memories of heroes who were killed. You know, I think of my brothers and sisters in the Marshal Service who were ambushed during their enforcement operations. And then even more recently, in 2013, fallen hero Sean Collier, who was murdered by those cowardly terrorists, as well as Special Agent Joseph Peters, who was ambushed in Afghanistan while on a mission with Army CID. So I wish, you know, again, it was a cooperative effort, not just between the agencies and the corporations, but also members of Congress, in terms of recognizing the absolute priority to sustain the funding, because otherwise the consequences could be fatal. And, you know, as much as Craig and I love doing the candlelight vigil each year where we honor the fallen, we definitely do not like the numbers being higher than zero.
You know, the show's not intended to be an indictment on Congress and the administration on funding, but you know, if the average American took a look at where we're spending money, how money's spread out, and particularly the way the sequester, you know, impacted federal law enforcement officers, you know, you'd be surprised. I'll put it at that. You know, we were surprised after 9/11 how little was, you know, ten times more was being put in to fight wildland fires, you know, than to, you know, protect ourselves from terrorist attacks. You know, so, you know, I think, you know, we could take a fresh look at that, you know, and perhaps, you know, start a trend of doing things in a little bit of a different way. Craig, we got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. I'd like for you to just briefly talk about some of the other programs at the Memorial Fund and how people can get involved and donate and be a partner.
One thing I'd love to encourage your listeners to do is go to our website. That's lawmemorial.org. And there's just a ton of great information, stories, photographs, really compelling information, a lot of facts and figures similar to what we've talked about a little bit today. We also have something on our website, on our homepage, called Recently Fallen Alerts. And basically, this allows anyone interested, and I'd encourage you to sign up for this, excuse me, to get an alert every time an officer is killed somewhere in America. It happens once every 54 hours, so it's happening quite often. And these alerts go out when that fatality occurs, tells you who that officer was, where they were serving, and what were the circumstances of the death, and usually refers you to a newspaper article to provide more details. I think one of the things that comes out of that program is we're sensitizing law enforcement people, but also the public, about the threats officers face each and every day. We should never take it for granted. Officers need to treat every assignment as potentially life-threatening. And the public, as John says, needs to make sure the officers get the resources to do their job safely and effectively.
If you would like more information about FLIOA, John, they should go to the website.
Yes, www.FLEOA.org.
Last point, Tony, I would mention is our National Law Enforcement Museum. It's now underway. I think we've talked a little bit about that in past shows. We hope to open that museum in 2016, and there will be more information on the website about the museum effort as well.
Right, and there's a lot of stuff associated with that, which we just don't have time, you know, to get into the artifacts, you know, the witness to history, you know, that you're doing. I encourage all folks to visit the website, particularly of both organizations. There's a wealth of very interesting information for law enforcement officers. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this show today. Thank you for joining us. Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Have a good weekend, everybody.